Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
First dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? My dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
So Howard, thanks for coming and talking to us today. I think we should probably start off at the beginning. How did you get into refereeing, and how did you first decide you wanted to be a referee?
Well, I hate anybody to think that when I was 7 or 8 I had this long-held ambition to be a football ref. I don't think anybody at that age does, and if they do, then it's kind of strange, isn't it? And like so many other kids, thousands and thousands up and down the country, I was an aspiring footballer. I wanted to be a professional footballer. I was football crazy, watching, playing, and just genuinely thought I had what it took, like so many kids, I guess. And looking back, clearly I didn't. I was miles away, but that's what I wanted to be. And I tried hard to develop my skills locally in this, you know, the school team, the regional team, Rotherham boys team, if you like. I live up in South Yorkshire and still do. And on a Sunday team as well. I'd become aware of the refereeing side of the game through my dad, because he'd become a ref himself when he was in his probably early 30s. He'd been a bit of a local player and became a player manager. And the referee sometimes wouldn't arrive, attend, or wouldn't be appointed to the game. It was local stuff, so they were short of match officials. And he'd step in and take charge of the game because somebody had to. And he quite enjoyed it. He's got a booming voice, a big personality. I think he quite enjoyed the idea of being a ref. So he took it up, got qualified. And so when I was sort of like in my early teens, he was still reffing, and obviously I'd go and watch him now and again, but I didn't want to be a ref. And it was only when it was obvious I wasn't going to be a footballer, when he came to me and said, look, you know, we've got a course coming up locally to qualify some more people as referees. Do you fancy it? You know, earn a few quid. We know we're short of refs, and maybe, you know, you'd be okay at it. And at first I was resistant, and, you know, in my mind's eye, referees they were all bald old men, just like what I am now, innit?
No comment.
but I was 17, 18 at the time, and I can distinctly remember thinking it might be nice to have some younger people involved. I might stand out because I'm a bit younger than the norm. This was in the late 1980s, and I said, go on then, I'll give it a go. So me and a guy from school went down to the course, 6-week course, which we passed, I think the 19th of December 1989 was the day when I passed my first ever exam, which qualified me as a ref. And I'd never, ever blown a whistle in my life. It's a bit like them giving you a driving licence just because you know the highway code. Mm. I'd done no practical reffing. And I took charge of my first game a few weeks later. And looking back, you know, to that night in December 89, if somebody had said to me, you know, you're going to go on and take charge of a World Cup final, I'd have thought they were crazy. I mean, obviously somebody was going to go on and do that game. Mm. It turned out to be me. So, you know, there's amazing ways to do amazing things in this sport, even if you don't have that God-given talent that you need to be a professional footballer.
And when you first started out, presumably you started out local leagues and made your way through up the levels. Was it, I mean, because I'm interested to know, because when a football player, if I talk to a football player and they tell me, I always say to them, was it obvious from the beginning you were much better than everyone else? And they always say yes.
Yeah.
But with refereeing, I imagine it's a bit more nuanced than that. It's a bit more about experience and about authority and about sort of learning your way through it. So did you find that you made quite a lot of mistakes early on and you worked your way through in that way? Or was it a case of fitness and keeping up and keeping authority and all that sort of thing?
I think at an early stage, I think it was obvious I had some character traits which made it likely that I'd make a successful ref. I mean, you know, people would say, well, I think that you've got something there. I think you're pretty good at recognising fouls. You've got a calmness about you. You know, the way you treat people or deal with people, it's, yeah, I like it. You know, I mean, people seem to respond positively to you. So, yeah, it's not like a talent that you have as a kid. I remember my lad who's 16 now, when I took him to play football, 8, there were kids 8 on the pitch who clearly had some talent, you know, could dribble a ball, could hit a ball properly at that age, sort of. And refereeing is different, you're right, and you do have to develop a lot of what you do. Learn skills, you learn the laws of the game, but that's just a small part of it. You know, learning how to handle people, learning where to move, you know, learning to just hold your gaze when a tackle's gone in, don't turn your head too soon, don't focus too much on the ball. Just, you know, learn from experience of you know, how to get better each time. And a lot of that learning comes from making mistakes.
Yeah.
But top referees will all have certain character traits which make them better than others. Mm. And I guess those come through quite early. And you have some early successes. You know, you'll get a couple of decent assessments under your belt, which encourages you to keep going. And then you might get promoted to the next level. I mean, it took me 14 years from starting to making it to the Premier League to the Premier League referees list. I mean, so it's not a quick thing, and it's a bit quicker now.
Working full time all through that,
and working full time as well. You know, with like all the guys do, until you get onto the Championship. Now they're professional this year for the first time. The guys on the Championship, the Premier League guys have been professional for 15 years. But yeah, you're working full time as well. So it's a hobby. It becomes quite a well paid hobby towards the top end of the game, and then it becomes a profession. But the problem with it is it still takes 5, 6, 7 years to make it to a really good level. And it has to, because you have to hone your skills and develop your trade and, you know, and learn from every situation. I was doing 4 games a weekend when I was fit enough to do it, when I was young enough. When I first started, I used to watch Rotherham United home and away. I was a season ticket holder, big fan, been to 70-odd grounds watching the club through the Championship, League One, League Two, ups and downs, the life of a lower league football fan, as you'll know. And then I used to play on a Sunday morning for a pub team, and I used to referee on a Sunday afternoon. I was football crazy. And then I thought, if I'm serious about getting further up the refereeing ladder, something's got to go. And I thought, probably playing. I'll referee on a Sunday morning as well, and that'll help me get better. And it did. But there wasn't a promotional route through Sunday football. You had to do Saturday football to get promoted. So I decided to sacrifice going to watch Rotherham away from home and only watch them at home, and refereed every other Saturday. So I was combining a few things. And then in the end, I just made every Saturday available for refereeing. Didn't play, didn't want to get injured. So I'd do games on Saturday morning, school games. Saturday afternoon, I'd do a game more regionally. I'd do 2-2 on a Sunday. And I learned from every single game. I learned from every situation in every game. Hundreds and hundreds of decisions I've made over the course of my life in hundreds of games. And each time you make a decision, you get like a feeling about whether that's right or not. You get an instant feedback from the players, for example. I don't mean these orchestrated reactions you see on the Premier League where players try to get somebody sent off. I mean those gut feelings that you get from a reaction that tells you if you've got something right, if other people agree with you, that sort of thing. And it makes you better all the time. It develops a gut instinct which makes you better at what you do.
Did you... presumably you remember your first professional game you officiated. What sort of age are we talking here? How long ago was that? And which game was it?
The first... When you say officiated, obviously I came through the ranks as an assistant referee first.
Yeah, I mean referee, sorry, in the middle.
In the middle, my first ever game as a referee in the professional game was in what's now League Two, which would have been called Division Three at the time, back in 2000, the fourth tier. And that was between Darlington and Exeter City up at Feetham's. That was the first ever game that I refereed in the professional game. I'd been a Premier League assistant before that. I'd been a Football League assistant before that. Mm. But that was the first ever time I took charge of a professional game. My first Premier League game was 3 years later in 2003 between Fulham and Wolverhampton Wanderers. Fulham were playing at Loftus Road at the time when Craven Cottage was still being redeveloped, but when it was out of use, not being used at the time when they played at Loftus Road. They were big steps. I would still say my biggest step was actually running the line on the Football League. I did a game at Burnley against Shrewsbury Town at Turf Moor in 2006. I was a 25-year-old. And the reason it was big for me is because as a mad passionate fan of a professional football club, a Football League club, and having travelled up and down the country on coaches, on trains, spent a lot of my own money watching my football club and knowing how much it hurt when my team lost, and they lost a lot, I knew how much it meant to people.
Yeah,
and don't get me wrong; it matters at other levels. It matters in the Conference. It matters in the Southern League and the Isthmian League and the Northern Premier League and Northern Counties leagues. But this, for me, was really important stuff. This was people's livings you were dealing with. These were professional footballers, professional coaches, and this is where it really was at. And for me, that was still a significant day. That night at Turf Moor when I first walked onto a pitch as an active match official with a flag in my hand, and I wasn't a brilliant assistant, but with a flag in my hand, involved in the Football League, which is what I'd like coveted all them years. You know, I knew everything about all of. I could name all 92 clubs, grounds. I could name them all. You know what I mean? I was that sort of a kid.
Yeah,
you know
what
I mean? Mad passionate football fan.
And presumably, I mean, one of the hallmarks of the lower leagues is this intensity of feeling and of the crowd being on top of you, and the grounds are smaller. And I imagine that's particularly felt when you're running the line. Is it something you were aware of, or did you have training to sort of zone that out, or were you just so focused that it didn't come into play at that stage, even so early in your career?
It was something you were very much aware of. I mean, you know, particularly like I say, some of the lower league grounds, they're close enough to touch you. You know, I remember coming off grounds with, you know, stuff on my bike, you know, be it somebody who spat on my bike from behind, or would it be a half a pie or something like that? And you don't get training for that. You learn from your own experiences and from speaking to colleagues, you know, and you learn to develop a thick skin and broad shoulders. And there were places that were really tough. I mean, the far side at Everton at Goodison Park, where the assistant runs the line there, it's really, really hostile, you know. The fans behind are really, really partisan. All fans are. But, you know, anything that goes against Everton, no matter how clear it is, creates a reaction.
That's just
how
they are.
It's just how they are. You know what I mean? I love Everton. I love it as a club. But their fans were really, really partisan, and still are, as far as I know. And it made it tough. And you had to be really... You had to learn to block it out. You had to learn just to accept that, you know, that reaction would come at certain places on certain decisions, no matter how clear it was. It didn't mean you were wrong. And I'd say to younger guys later on when I became more experienced, you know, expect a reaction. Don't let it put you out of your stride. Don't let it make you think you've made a mistake just because you're getting a negative reaction. Nah, you know, be resilient. The thing that referees need more than anything else is mental toughness, mental resilience.
I mean, because I've been at games at Fratton Park, as we talked about before we started this, about when I've seen linesmen, particularly, or assistant referees particularly, getting a lot of abuse to the point where I'd find it distasteful, a little bit uncomfortable, even though I was passionate about the team I supported. Was there any moment where you thought, I'm not sure about this is for me. I mean, I'm a bit of a glutton for punishment here. I don't know if this is right.
I mean, during the course of my career, yeah, I mean, that's going to happen. At some point, all of us will suffer from difficult days at the office, and you'll come home. And maybe some of it is because you've not performed particularly well. You're like a player. I mean, you know, sometimes you'll see the ball like a beach ball, really big. The decisions are easy. You're in the flow. And then other times, other games, you'll see it like a ping pong ball. You know what I mean? It's like difficult to get the right call. The harder you try, the worse you do. Yeah. And you go through peaks and troughs like that. It's a confidence game. And sometimes, yeah, you'll have a difficult game. You'll get some stick, you'll come home, you'll throw your bag in the corner and think, like you've just said, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's easier things to do on a Saturday afternoon. It's easier going down to Millmore or wherever it was that I was watching my football at the time. And when I've thrown the bag in the corner on those days, I've probably thought to myself, that's it, I'm packing in. But because I do love the game and I do love officiating, because most of the time it goes well, and because it's difficult and challenging, when it goes well, it's a great feeling of satisfaction. Yeah. And because I've got good people supporting me and pushing me, each time I've gone back and I've picked my bag back up and gone out and refereed the following weekend. And you know, in moments like I experienced in the summer of 2010, when, you know, at 20 past eight, I'm stood in the tunnel in Johannesburg on the 11th of July, about to take charge of the World Cup final. I'm so glad I've picked my bag back up each time, even though I had some stick from somebody, some distasteful stick, like you've talked about, which does happen. I'm glad I've gone back and picked my bag back up, because it means I'm going to referee in the World Cup final rather than watch it at home, which would have been the case if I'd have packed in at that point. So, yeah, there are times when you feel like quitting, but you know, they're few and far between.
So let's fast forward to you becoming a Premier League referee then. And as I mentioned to you earlier, the Football Ramble has a book out as well this week. And as I didn't mention this to you because I wanted to say it to you now, I do a chapter on referees. And I went out with one of my colleagues and we tried the Premier League referees fitness test. Yeah, and it was obviously astonishingly difficult and, you know, hilariously inept and all that other stuff. One thing that I found particularly fascinating about it is that there are men a lot older than me doing that on a monthly basis, I think. And I think they've even made it even harder since I did it. You've got to be astonishingly fast and astonishingly quick and fit to be a top-level referee. And I think that's underplayed in the current media. It's underplayed in how important, how fit, and how quick you guys are. And did you find it difficult to keep the fitness up?
I didn't find it difficult on the back of the fact that we were professional. So even though I came into refereeing as a hobby and had a full-time job, and then when I made it onto the Premier League, I was able to reduce my hours. I'd become a police officer, and I was able to reduce my hours to half-time. And then I actually took a career break, a five-year break. So I was able to focus my training and do it properly. And we had sports scientists. So there's two full-time sports scientists, fitness coaches that look after the referees. So it's all very well supported by professional people. And they would give you a schedule every week based on your own match commitments. And you'd know what to be doing on what particular day based on a percentage of your heart rate max. So it was spoon-fed to you, and you just followed it out. You recorded it onto your heart rate monitor. You sent it in so he could check that you were doing the right stuff. It made life easy. But that fitness level you're talking about, it has to be that way, because in the last minute of a big game, a tiring, physically demanding game, you might have to make a big call in one penalty area. And then in the space of 20 seconds, you might have to make another equally big call at the other end. In the other penalty area, and you've got to get from one to the other in the last minute after a difficult game without thinking about your legs or your lungs. You've just got to be thinking about the decision you're going to be making or that you need to make. All those cognitive skills need to be based in the decision rather than thinking about the pain that you're suffering in your legs or your lungs. And you're right, there's people at 45, there's people at 50 refereeing. You know, the age limit has gone. It has got harder over the years. It's got much harder. But like I say, it's because you need that level of fitness where you don't have to worry about how you're going to get from A to B. You've got to be naturally, you've got to be able to do it automatically. I finished refereeing in 2014. I couldn't pass the test now, and I still train. I still do some recreational training. But because I'm not at that level anymore, because I'm not following the plans, because I'm not following the diets, just because I've turned down my professionalism in that respect, then there's no way I could do the fitness test myself.
It's fascinating to me because we always hear about players getting half an hour here or 60 minutes there to get their match fitness back, and if they start to tire, they'll be substituted off, obviously. No one really ever says that about referees. It's unheard of, really, unless there's a proper injury of a referee to be replaced or anything like that. So, and of course, your physical fitness is linked to your mental fitness and your ability to make the right decision under pressure and all that stuff. I came away from trying to do that test, and it sounds obvious now, but thinking they're professional athletes. They're absolutely professional athletes, and I don't think the referees get the respect they deserve on that basis.
I think the fitness levels are high. There's no doubt about it. And you're right. The test has got even harder lately. And even though people look at me now and say, "Oh, you've not changed. You know, you've not put any weight on," but my fitness levels have really declined because I'm not doing that sort of high level training, that supervised training. If you compare our fitness levels to those of the players, you talk about referees not getting the benefits of the credit for being fit. Actually, players are the same. But if you speak to an average person who follows various sports and talked about fit sports people, they would not put footballers, I don't think, in the top sort of like echelons of which ones are fit and which ones aren't. They talk about some of the Olympians that we've seen.
Tour de France, something like that.
The Tour de France. They might talk about even some rugby players. I don't know, but I can tell you the footballers are mega fit. We're in a situation now where the referees in the Premier League will visit a club pre-season and then they'll go to another club mid-season and they have the option to train with them on a morning and then they speak to the players. And it's all about trying to gain better understanding of each other's roles. And I went to Sunderland in my last season and they were training. I trained with them and they were doing some 40-metre shuttles. And I thought, I'll give it a go. And to my right-hand side was Titus Bramble. And I thought, Titus, a bit of a lumpen, you know what I mean? He's not the sort of guy you'd think would be that fit. I thought, I can probably take him, you know what I mean? I was a lot older than him, obviously. But I thought, I'm pretty fit here. I'm pretty strong. I couldn't live with him, honestly. No. I was so, so far behind. And at the very end of the row of people was one of the coaches, Steve Guppy.
Oh, yeah.
Same age as me. I remember Steve used to be at Leicester. And me and Steve were about the same level.
Yeah, he was nippy in the day, though.
Steve. Well, he was a fit lad, fit lad. But me and Steve had the same level. The players were miles ahead. And, and that was a realisation for me, just about the fitness levels that these guys have got and have to have. You know what I mean? If you play in a pressing game like Spurs, Liverpool, my God, I mean, you can't do that for 90 minutes, can you? The fitness levels that you need to do that, wow, it's pretty high. So I think the players need recognition as well for just how fit they are.
Well, I can't do any of it for any minutes. I mean, but I do take the point.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
In the Premier League, of course, the scrutiny is a lot higher, and you're on the end of a lot of media attention and stuff like that. And I suppose writing a book as you have now, it must feel quite nice to be able to, it must be quite freeing to be able to actually have your say as well, because you're so well restrained throughout your professional career that you're not really able to say anything at all. And people talk about, should referees be on TV to explain their decisions and stuff, but now since you've moved into the media, you're able to do that. It must be a nice break for you to be have that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I personally found it a little bit frustrating at times that we weren't able to speak about. It's
you would have been in favour of being able to do that, would you?
Yeah, it's a tricky balance, isn't it? Because the game is all about the players, and then it's about the fans. So the players create the spectacle, the fans create the atmosphere, and then you need other people to assist in making that happen, don't you? So the referees are somebody who assists in helping that event to happen. But even though I'm quite happy when nobody's speaking about me and nobody's commenting about a performance, no matter how well I've done, that's absolutely fine. But a lot of people do want to speak about you when things go wrong, and they do want to focus on you. Look at Anthony Taylor this past few days when he refereed Liverpool versus Manchester United, and so much talk before he even blows a whistle, and then no talk afterwards because he doesn't mess up. And I went to Twitter and mentioned that. I said, you know, nobody will speak about him now, even though he was under unfair and unnecessary significant pressure, because he's not messed up. And they only would have spoke about him if he had messed up. I think there's some ground that could be gained in just giving, I suppose, the officials an opportunity at well-timed points just to speak out now and again.
But in that example you gave about Anthony Taylor, he wouldn't have been able to say anything in the lead-up to the game that would have made his situation better, though, would he, in
no.
that particular example?
No, and he wouldn't have wanted to. And the bottom line with that was that nobody should have been speaking about him.
No.
You know,
and Mourinho will probably face a fine for that, won't he? So
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, I had a situation in 2011 where Chelsea played Manchester United and both Carlo Ancelotti and Sir Alex Ferguson made comments about my appointment, which wasn't a negative comments, but because they spoke about me, they were fined. And those rules were in place for a good reason, to try to avoid increasing pressure on match officials before the game. And everybody knows they exist. And what Mourinho said in itself wasn't that inflammatory, wasn't really inflammatory at all. But it did oxygenate the argument, and he would know that. So you're better off when nobody speaks. I just think that now and again, it would be useful for people to have an insight into a referee's decision-making, or an insight into them as human beings, because that would make it, I guess, obvious that they do care about the game. I used to hate the idea that people thought we'd make a decision, get in the car, drive home and forget all about it.
Yeah.
Nothing could be further from the truth. We care massively about what we do. And of course, we've got personal pride at stake as well. I guess if you said, you know, the referee should be available for a press conference post-match, the only time he'd ever be asked a question is when it was apparent that he'd made a mistake or done something wrong. So I understand the difficulties in giving them a platform, because it would generally only ever be utilised when there was a negative connotation about what they'd done.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's unlikely to invite you in to say well done. And
of course not. And you wouldn't expect that. But whereas players, managers, they have to face the music when they do something wrong. They also get the opportunity to speak about something they've done well. You know, what a great game, what a great hat-trick, what a great substitution.
Yeah.
How tactically well you did on a particular game. Whereas in refereeing, it would just really, I guess, come down to a mistake. On the odd occasion, it might be about clarification. It might be about...
Did you used to see that a lot? Did you used to see punditry, when you were refereeing at the top level, did you used to see punditry post the weekend where they would be misinterpreting or just getting wrong the laws of the game?
Yeah, and you
weren't able to say anything because of that?
Of course, sometimes they would. Yeah, sometimes pundits would get something wrong. Or, I mean, sometimes it would just be down to a matter of opinion.
Yeah.
I used to dislike the fact that people would speculate about why I'd given a certain decision.
Yeah.
And I'd rather just be able to say it for myself.
Yeah.
Even if it meant just saying, look, I've made a mistake. That's all it is.
But the thing is, though, Howard, too many of those in a few months, perfectly normally, if you weren't to say anything, if you start highlighting that, are you not being hoisted by your own petard anyway?
Yeah, you are, absolutely. And that's another reason why it's difficult to do, because there's only so many times that you can come out and say, made a mistake,
yeah.
Isn't there? You know, yeah. At the end of the day.
Before you become Joe Hart.
I mean, and poor Joe, I mean, you know, you see the way that...
That was unfair, actually. I didn't mean that.
No, but goalkeepers and referees are very similar, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You can have a blinder for 89 minutes and make a mistake,
yeah,
and you become the villain.
Absolutely.
A blinding game, making great decisions. You make one bad decision in the last minute, you're a villain. If you're centre forward, you miss lots of chances, have a poor 89 minutes, score the winner, you're a hero. So, you know, it's very similar in many ways. So, but yeah, you're right. It is difficult. But just on some occasions, and I say some, I wouldn't want like it to be as a matter of routine, but on some occasions, I think there's an opportunity for the referee to come out and speak. Just as a guy who's employed professionally to do a job, to come out and just say, this is why I gave this decision, or, you know, this is how this looked at the time. I've seen it back and it looks different. Mm. Yeah. Hold hands up sometimes and say, you know, it's just a mistake. I wanted to do it. I'd made a poor call to give a penalty to Manchester United against Tottenham. It was a mistake. On pitch level, it just looked like Aurelio Gomez had clearly clattered into Michael Carrick.
Yeah.
From a through ball from Rooney, which had taken me a long way from the play. It was a lovely ball. I was in a good position, but the ball had quality about it. It cut the defence. It also put me out of position. I managed to see that Carrick got onto the end of the ball first with his left foot and then got wiped out by Gomez. That's the way it looked. Straightforward penalty appeal, straightforward decision, gave the penalty. When you watch it from an aerial view, you can see, yeah, Carrick gets his foot on the ball, but then Gomez gets blindside to me, the other side of Carrick,
yeah,
get a big glove on the ball and pushed it out for a throw-in. I couldn't appreciate that sequence from the pitch level. I gave the penalty. Gut feeling told me I got it wrong. I wanted to come out afterwards and say, look, can I just say what I saw at the time and how it played out? Just to give people an understanding.
Yeah.
It will kill the argument. Instead, no, couldn't say anything. And instead it was like, oh, well, you know, why is he giving that? What is he giving it for this? Is he giving it for that?
Mm.
You know, it just rumbled on. It rumbled on. And I just wanted to kill the argument by saying, look, guys, I've seen it again. It's a mistake.
So I wasn't going to bring this in just yet, but I will do now in light of what you've just said. The video technology question, which is inevitably going to be asked by someone like me, of someone like you, would you have appreciated or been in favour of that aerial view you just mentioned being available at the time for that to be overturned? Or do you think that's a precedent we shouldn't set in football and video technology should stay out of the game as far as possible?
I think we're at a stage now where some sort of trial of a video system is pretty inevitable, and I would support it.
Okay.
I would support it. And I think that I'm...
For all decisions?
No. We'll delve into that, but I think that I hold a common view with the other referees on most of them. I'm not canvassed opinion, I don't know, but I've got a strong feeling that if I'd have phoned Anthony Taylor an hour before the game, Liverpool against Manchester United, if I'd have phoned him and said, Anthony, we can give you video technology tonight. I can come and sit in a van, watch all the angles, be in communication with you, and I can help you get things right.
Mm.
Would you take it or not? I'm pretty sure he'd say, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, I'd love it.
But would he take it because the pressure is so high and the lack of support for referees at the top level in the media and in punditry among other people is so absent that you guys feel you needed it? Because, or is it because it genuinely would make the game better? Because my concern with it would be that football is reliant on its popularity, and its popularity is based on its simplicity. And the moment we start bringing that stuff in, I know inevitably it's going to happen, as you rightly said, you know, there will be a trial and it will come in, whatever happens. But just, is there not merit in the argument to suggest that actually it should stay as simple as it can be, and we should give more support to referees when they make mistakes rather than bring video technology into it to essentially solve a problem that we've created ourselves?
That would be lovely, wouldn't it? That would be really nice if you could say, it's just human error, just get on with it, accept it, it's just an acceptance. But unfortunately, I don't think we're in that position, and I don't think we're going to get to that position. I think, if anything, it's going to go the other way. I think there's an expectation that you know, the cause will be right, and because there's big rewards, and because there's high pressure and analysis and scrutiny, and more column inches and website pages are being filled by football talk. I've seen the way it affects people, football. I've seen the way that, you know, I was on a flight a few weeks ago and I was sat next to an off-duty airline pilot, and we're talking about aviation and, you know, and he'd been to on a simulator course. And chatting away, and you know, everything's nice and intelligent, articulate, mature human being. And then we got talking about football. And honestly, I thought he'd gone to the toilet and his twin brother had come back.
I recognise that.
Do you know what I mean? It's like he's coming out with random loony statement. It's just like, wow. Oh, yeah, yeah, all referees hate this club. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, we only ever get rubbish referees. Oh, yeah, they clearly hate us. And I'm thinking, what's happened to this sensible guy who you know, who flies planes?
Yeah. I understand you mean. A really good friend of mine is a lawyer, really well-respected, works in the city. Very articulate, interesting man. As soon as you start talking about Liverpool, he's like he's a different person. He says to me, he was sold to me over after a couple of beers after Liverpool lost the Champions League final in 2007.
Yeah.
This is the worst night of my life. This is the worst night of my life. You know, it's like there's no perspective, is there?
I know. So, I like it in some ways. I like that people care so much.
The passion is what endears you to it in the first instance, isn't it?
Exactly. And I see that in myself. I'll go to a game, I'll watch Rotherham United, and I'll be in the stand, and I'm giving some stick to the ref. I'm thinking, what am I doing? And I think, I hope he doesn't see me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then like a day later, I'll think, what was I doing? You know what I mean? I'll calm down again.
Do you find yourself having to explain decisions in the crowd to people?
Oh, they're always pointing at me, or what's that for, Webby? Or they know where my allegiance lies as a club, as a fan of Rotherham. And then if I'm shaking my head or put my head in my hands after a decision, it gets tweeted. Even Howard Webb thinks that's a shocker. So, you know, you've got to be careful about your body language. But yeah. I get carried away with the moment as well. So I don't think we're going to get close to a position where people just accept it as a mistake. When football was invented back in the late 1800s, the rules were drawn up to assist in giving some sort of order to it, to assist in the enjoyment of the participants, so it wasn't just a free-for-all. Mm. But it wasn't meant to be so serious.
No.
I mean? And there was a guy put in the middle who was expected to try to control it. It's called the referee because, well, actually, at one time, the clubs would bring their own people to arbitrate the
a
game.
A lot of things would be decided by committee, wouldn't
they? Yeah, exactly. Like and then the referee was somebody that, if the two umpires that the clubs brought to the game, there was two umpires, one from each club, on the pitch, and they would make calls. And if they disagreed, they decided that they would have to refer it to another person. So he stood on the edge of the pitch. He would be the referee.
Right.
They would refer
okay.
things to him for a final call. Mm. Then they thought, OK, we'll get rid of the club umpires. We'll put him onto the pitch himself and he can be the sole arbiter.
Yeah.
So that's where referees come from. But, I mean, it wasn't meant to be this serious. Mm. Now it is serious, but the tools that the referee have are not really that much different to what they were back in the day.
That's
so,
a good point, yeah, that's
so,
a good point.
So, you know, I'm a supporter of trials, not because I say, yeah, this is the answer, but just because I think we need to move the argument forward. I think any time you get a big call that's wrong, that's consequential, I think we'll go back to, oh, well, why have we not got video technology?
Yeah.
I think that the reason Anthony Taylor would want it is because it would give him reassurance. It would give him reassurance that he's not going to make a humdinging mistake that could be career changing.
So
for
you could
him.
Even envisage it not even necessarily being used if it's not needed to be used.
Well,
the problem is, I guess it depends how it's implemented. If Anthony Taylor makes a terrible decision, will he get a buzz on his ear and be told? Or I mean,
well, this is the crux of the matter, isn't it? Mm. So having accepted that it's coming in a trial basis at least, you've then got to think, and I think we have to accept that, you then have to think, right, how are you going to do it? What are you going to look at? What type of situations? When are you going to look at them? And who's going to instigate that look? So the three options as I see in terms of how the review is going to be instigated is either you simply give the coach or the captain, like a DRS system in cricket, the opportunity to appeal, to ask for a review on a situation, and he can do that maybe two times a half, and he keeps the review if it's turned out to be correct.
Is that not chaos, though? Is this just not chaos?
It could be. Until we try it, we don't know. It could be used tactically, can't it, as well, of course. So that's an option. It's quite a simple one, really. You've still got the question of when does that review take place?
Yeah.
Because if it's for a penalty appeal and the referees, if they've got doubt, they won't give a decision. If they've got doubt about a penalty, they won't give it. And that means, quite often, the ball will stay alive.
Yeah.
So you need a level of certainty to give a penalty. And if you've not got that level of certainty, you'll wave it away. Now, if you wave it away and the ball immediately goes out for a goal kick or a corner or gets wellied out for a throw-in, then you've got a chance to look at it. But actually, it could stay alive for another 5 minutes.
They go up the other end and score.
Exactly. So at what point do you review it? Now, is it at the next stoppage when and all manner of things could have happened in that time? Mm. Is it that the manager is allowed to call timeout on the play at that moment? And the play stops, but that could prevent a counter attack, couldn't it?
Mm.
When you know they're out of balance.
See my initial point though. This is essentially removing the game from the simplicity of its roots of where people fall in love with it in the first instance. And I now I feel like I do whenever I talk about this. I feel like I sound like this Luddite guy who just wants everything to be back to what it used to be like. And I don't mean it in that way. I just mean that football's in danger of eating itself. We talked about this a second ago. You talked about how it was never supposed to be this serious. For me, it is quite serious. It's too serious probably now. And this is just another step along the line for that. And I fear that it's not actually going to solve anything. It's just going to serve to change the game as we know it. And fine, we might get 100% of decisions right. But on the other hand, sort of, so what?
Yeah, and you'll never get to 100% decisions right because...
But you guys already get 96% so much, right anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they do okay, but I mean, there's so much subjectivity as well. So what you think is a right decision and what I think might be two different things. So, you know, and you still... So if you move on to the next sort of instigation of review, could be the on-field referee who asks for something to be checked. Well, you know, sometimes you don't even know something's happened.
No.
You know, it can be a blindside handball that you don't even think he's looking at because you're not aware anything's happened.
Yeah.
Or it might be a yellow card offence that looks like a bog-standard yellow card. You stop the game, you give a yellow card, and you know just from a few more degrees of angle, it opens up and you see, my goodness, that's a red card. Oh, I've missed it. It used to happen to me. I'd come home and I'd put match of the day on and think, how have I not seen that? It's a red card now. I haven't seen it again. It's a TV red card, we call them.
Right, okay.
So that's a problem because then basically the referee would play it safe and get everything reviewed to make sure he'd miss nothing. Or you get the guy in the van, like the job I do with BT Sport, and he can just be monitoring the game. But then you've got problems with that as well because what do you check? You check every corner or goal kick because corners can lead to goals.
Yeah. This is my thing.
It's complicated. And people who think it's not don't understand... Don't understand the intricacies of the situation, and there's loads of them. All I would say is, let's move the argument forward by trialing it, and if we can find a system which is palatable, which crucially doesn't change the basic fabric and the way the game is played, then and that actually benefits the game, then it's worth embracing.
One thing I really wanted to, when I found that I was going to be talking to you, I really wanted to ask you was. A lot of people say, when we have listeners who listen to our show and they ask us questions about different parts of football and refereeing and stuff like that, one thing that always comes up from fans is how Premier League players can seemingly get away with shouting and swearing in the face of referees and officials without any sort of consistent punishment. And I've seen, you know, I don't want to sort of name individuals, but I've seen individual players screaming and shouting, clearly swearing, in the general... area and proximity of the referee in their direction and not been punished for doing so. Now, when I played football at a very poor level, you couldn't get away with that. You couldn't even really get away with swearing in the same area without getting a huge punishment. Do you know why referees are so reluctant to implement any sort of punishment for that?
I think a few things I would say about that. First of all is I've seen the same things as you. I've seen players get away with stuff on the field that when stronger action should have been taken. I've been guilty of that myself. Of accepting too much, and I've also heard swearing on local fields as well.
Yeah.
Some of that is down to the power of example. Local players will see that swearing has happened on the professional game and tried it themselves. I used to get that quite a lot from local level refs. You know, it's like why do you allow it? And I'd say, well, listen, I've heard it on local levels as well. But I think. There's two or three things at play here. One is that when the camera zooms in on the player, it's not always clear and obvious to see exactly where the player is, where the referee is, how obvious it would be to the ref. So having acknowledged openly that it sometimes does happen and referees don't take action, sometimes the referee doesn't actually see it in the way you might see it on TV.
Right.
So you don't hear it, you don't see it, you've already turned your back. There might be a long distance between the player and the referee, even though on TV it's not that
and
obvious.
And it's loud there as well.
Exactly, so you don't hear it quite so clearly. That's offering up a defence for some situations, but not all. And I totally believe in being candid. I've tried to be as candid as I can in the book as well.
Yeah,
I think that the pressure that the game brings but weighs heavy on the ref. So I think sometimes there's a feeling that you shouldn't overreact and that actually it might be probably easier to turn a deaf ear or blind eye because... When you send somebody off in a Premier League game, it's a big decision, and it creates a controversy that referees are always keen to avoid. They're always keen to avoid controversy. You know, if you send a player off, that's a big talking point, and you don't want to be the talking point. You know, referees don't want to be the centre of attention. If you take a strong line on that, you're going to become the centre of attention. So you're trying to balance that against making sure you do your job properly and knowing that the power of example is strong and that there's an expectation that you will deal with players. But sometimes, I don't like to use the word bottle it, but I've probably bottled it in big games early on. Somebody's maybe said something and I've thought, God, is there an option to manage that? Should I? Cristiano Ronaldo, I booked him once for a foul in a Manchester derby at the Etihad for a foul on Sean Wright Phillips. And as I showed him the yellow card, he sarcastically applauded me.
Mm.
And the respect programme had just come in.
Mm.
And it put me in a position because, by rights, I should have sent him off for a second yellow card there.
Why didn't you do so?
Probably just the feeling that... Probably the feeling that... Or the fear that maybe I wouldn't be totally supported by the game.
Yeah.
It would be seen as an overreaction. It would be seen as... I didn't want to be a martyr. I didn't want to be a martyr to the cause.
Was that all going through your head at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I didn't want to be a martyr to the cause. I didn't want to send him off and then get abused because I'd overreacted. Or was there an opportunity to just manage that, give him a strong warning? Was that a better outcome for the spectacle of the game? Because this is 15 minutes into a Manchester derby where thousands of people have come to the game, spent good money to watch 22 of the best players. And here I am sending him off. It's his fault. I'm taking too much onto my shoulders there.
Yeah, because you're just the agent of the implementation of the laws of the game, right?
I mean,
I understand why it does, and I don't mean to denigrate you for taking that decision, but for me, it just seems a little bit sad that you have to worry about that. And really, if the yellow card that you gave out for the foul was presumably a straight yellow as well, and that was non-controversial, it seems a bit sad for the game as a whole that you can't feel that you can do your job properly because of that situation.
But that's the pressure, that's the monster of the game. You just talked about the game being a bit of a monster. I mean, the monster of the game creates that situation,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
You know, now, what the way we can deal with that is, I think it's happened a little bit this year. In the pre-season, the stakeholders got together and looked at a couple of issues of the game. The stakeholders being usually the PFA, the LMA, the league managers, the professional footballers, the referees, the league competitions themselves and the FA, and they've looked at what areas of the game can be improved upon. And holding in the penalty area is one, but also dissent. So the referees were told not to turn a deaf ear and a blind eye to player behaviour that's less than acceptable these days, you know, to front it up. And the clubs were visited and the managers and the players were told in no uncertain terms, look, if you step out of line, our referees have been told to deal with you in a firm way. And so far we've had 8 rounds in the Premier League and we've had, I think, 45 yellow cards for dissent in 8 rounds. Last year, in 38 rounds, we had 60. So we're almost at the same number. And it's happening. And I think player behaviour has been quite good this year. But what I have seen is players who step out of line. If you look at Harry Arter for Bournemouth, he got sent off at West Ham, 2 yellow cards. One was for a clear foul, which denied a promising attack, like a tactical foul. The first one was for dissent. And to be fair to Eddie Howe, he came out and fronted up on camera later and said, we were told before the season that if we stepped out of line, we'd be punished.
Mm.
Harry stepped out of line. He should have known better. He deserved the yellow card. Mm. And that led to the red card with no complaints.
That's what you need, isn't it?
And that's what you need. It was rammed down the throat. So I feared that they would ease off a little bit when things get harder. When they haven't done. When referees... You mentioned earlier about the one with Ronaldo. You said, if it's a clear yellow card, the first one, you couldn't see why I wouldn't follow it through. I can take your point on that. Because another time when referees don't follow it through is when they feel they've made a mistake and they don't want to compound it. So imagine a situation where in the second minute of the game, there's a shot on goal, it's blocked on the line by a defender, the referee blows the whistle and sends him off because he's, from his position, he's seen him block the ball with a hand, an arm.
Mm.
And therefore, it's a penalty and a red card. The reaction that he gets from every other player on that team is there's something more to this.
Yeah.
He's probably got a bad angle. He's probably just overreacted. He's misread it. He's not focused. Whatever reason, he's failed to see the fact that actually he cleared it with his head and not the arm.
Mm.
In the absence of other information, he can't turn that decision around. He's going to have to follow it through and send the player off. This is 2 minutes into the game. A player comes up and says, that's an effing disgrace, referee. Whatever he might say, that you would see on your TV through lip reading or whatever, that you could tell is foul language. That referee needs bloody big balls, didn't he, to send him off, or stupidity to send him off and put that team down to 9 men on after 2 minutes on the back of a decision that he's made. Can you put yourself in the shoes of the referee and understand why you would,
of course,
why you would turn absolutely a blind eye, a deaf ear to that
course
situation?
In that situation, 100%. I think I can understand it generally anyway.
Yeah.
I just think that it's not your fault. I don't think it's your fault. I think that you have to implement the laws as you see fit, and it's the player's responsibility to. Look, we're going to talk about your Annus Mirabilis 2010 anyway. So, yeah, when you refereed the Champions League final and the World Cup final the same year, you talk about that in great detail in the book. You talk about the famous Nigel de Jong decision, and you say you're very candid and very honest about it. And you actually talk about the World Cup final in quite a touching way, and I really enjoyed reading it. But you say very clearly on the Nigel de Jong thing, you didn't see it, you didn't have the right angle. But moreover, you said that you felt like you handled the game well, and I felt the same. But people were on your back because of the way the players acted, not because of the way you officiated.
Yeah.
Because people always say at the beginning of games, oh, don't we don't want to see the referees bring the cards out too early. And I understand that. And you say in the book as well, in other places, you know, if you can get your first yellow out halfway through the first half, you know you've got control of the game. That's a nice time to do it. But you obviously always can't always do that.
No.
So you must have been incredibly frustrated coming out the back of the World Cup final thinking, that could have gone better, obviously, but it's not really your fault. I mean, I watched the game in the Johannesburg fan park where there's a huge amount of passion for the game, and we all saw the Nigel de Jong sort of kung fu kick 100 times on the massive 100-foot big screen. You didn't get a chance to see it like that.
No.
So it's just a bit of a shame, really, that you're held responsible and have to change your behaviour and the way you officiate a game because of the way the players behave.
Yeah, and you know, with that particular game, we went in a way that we thought was prepared. I mean, we did all the usual sessions before the game, technical sessions, psychological sessions. We'd had physical training, of course, and nobody, all of the expertise in FIFA, we had a session from the technical study group talking about the way they thought the game would pan out.
Mm.
We spoke to the sports psychologist. Nobody said this is going to be a kicking match. Nobody expected that. I suspected it might not be a beautiful game because I can't remember many beautiful World Cup finals. But
and the Dutch with that type of team, as well.
But yeah. I mean, they've got some players in there who could put the foot in, but you know, but they could play really tidy football as well, couldn't they? You know what I mean, with real pace and purpose. And the Spanish, of course, were renowned for their exquisite type of tiki taki football. But you know, we never thought it'd be that sort of a game. And I went in thinking, okay, stay calm. Understand that the final might affect players a little bit because of what's at stake. Don't overreact, but do the job you're sent there to do. All the usual thoughts that you have before a game, you know what I mean? And I tried to go through a range of tactics to gain or maintain control of the game, and it was far from perfect. I mean, if I'd just seen that as a match report after the game and seen there being 14 yellow cards, I can't help but think that would have suggested that the game was out of control. And there were periods in that game where I feared it might go out of control, but I think we clung on to it. And you know, early in the game, there's a tackle. I think I put it in the book by Van Persie, which is a strong tackle.
It's
and
a
I,
nice I, piece of that. Yeah.
And I warn him in the way that I thought was the right thing to do, because I thought, you know, if I go straight in with a yellow card in this, I tell you what would have happened if I'd have gone in with a yellow card after 2 minutes. Bang, yellow card. I think it would have given for a tackle that was within the range of manageability. Not one of those where you've got no choice but to yellow card. Then I think there would have been a suggestion that I was nervous, that I overreacted, that was too hot to go to the card. Where else can I go now?
But you mentioned at that point, you say you'd refereed Robin van Persie a number of times before that, and normally he was quite a malleable, perfectly reasonable guy, and you said there was a change in him at that moment. He seemed different somehow at that moment.
He didn't acknowledge the yellow card. The word of advice. He didn't acknowledge the word of advice. Normally, I'd have a word, he'd tap me on the shoulder and say, okay, Howard, no problem. There was no engagement from him at all. No. You know what I mean?
Was that not a situation that he was just so focused?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. I think he was that focused. And when you speak to Bert van Marwijk later, I mean, Bert works in the same building as I do now in Saudi Arabia, and he's doing pretty well with the national team there. But, you know, he'll say that there was no pre-planned tactic to go and be really brutally, you know, aggressive. Mm. He said, you know, the players took it upon themselves to respond in the way that they did, and that's what, you know, that's again maybe what happens in an occasion of such magnitude. And these players are so close to becoming legends, aren't they? I mean, the English 66 team is still revered, and you know, all these 50 years on, so it's going to change their lives as well. So, you know, it. But you're right, it's down to the players. But the referee's there to to manage what's presented to him. And if you're at the top of your game, you should have the mental nous and agility and emotional intelligence to be able to adjust your style to cope. And were we successful in that way? Not totally. Did we manage to bring the game to a conclusion that was relatively, I don't know, satisfactory is the wrong word, but was the game intact at the end? It was.
We did the best you could.
Pretty much, yeah. And I'm not sure that anybody else would have done things different. I mean, we could easily have had two red cards in the first half. Mm. De Jong should have gone, for sure, with a different viewing angle.
The Spanish players, of course, very annoyed, I remember at the time, but was their reaction giving you any sort of indication that you were wrong to give them a yellow card then?
I say this in the book as well. At no point did it cross my mind that that should be a red. Mm. It wasn't like...
I know, because you do say very clearly, ooh, you didn't have the angle, you wouldn't have done anything different. But, I mean, just the player's reaction, because you mentioned earlier about sometimes players go very, very honestly react like that.
And you learn to read genuine play reaction a lot as a referee. You learn to read it, and it helps to guide you. And I don't want to mislead people by saying all those reactions that players orchestrate, you can tell the difference between a natural reaction. Yeah. If you know something's a red card, and you show a red, and the players react... They're
going through the motions, aren't they? They're playing to the crowd.
They do. You can tell the difference. You know what I mean? But you get a feeling based on those natural reactions. And the Spanish players were angry at that point. But I thought they were angry for a couple of reasons. One is because I thought it's yet another physical challenge, which is pretty strong. I'd had some yellows already. I even thought they wanted an advantage playing because the ball was headed on by Xabi Alonso, and it went to David Villa, who was in quite a bit of space in a good position to go forward. And I penalised, and a couple of players pointed towards David Villa, a couple of the Spanish players, and I thought, they obviously want advantage, but I thought, I can't play advantage.
Well, maybe they did.
Maybe, but knowing the Spanish players as I do, they would be quick to point out physical play.
Yeah.
They would. More so than in the Premier League.
Yeah.
More so than in the Premier League. And you know, I think there was also a reaction born out of the fact that there was some physicality to the challenge. But that said... I was never close to going red, simply because I just didn't have a view. I didn't see the point of contact. I saw it from over the shoulder of Alonso. You can see it on the video, which made me think, yeah, that's late and it's forceful, but that's what it is. It's reckless.
Yeah.
I didn't realise it actually involved the studs. It's a strange thing, really, because he's not straight-legged. He kind of like puts his foot up and Alonso comes into his foot and De Jong's leg bends as Alonso comes in to head the ball. Alonso does nothing wrong, of course, but it's such a weird thing to put your foot up in that position. It probably caught me by surprise as well.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about with great affection about obviously getting the opportunity to referee the World Cup final. You talk about the atmosphere and how great it was to be there and be a part of it. And I just wonder, looking back on it now, do you still feel very, obviously you feel very proud and it's a great part of your life, your professional life and your personal life, but is there a bittersweet element to it because of the way the game went? Do you think you could have done better, or do you think that it was just you had to play the hand you were dealt on that day?
Oh God, you've probably hit about eight nails on the head there in one go. Do I think I could have done better? Yes, of course. Do I think that I did fairly well with the hand that was dealt to me? Yes, I do. Do I feel... If I was to say I felt cheated, that people would just overreact to that because how can a referee feel cheated about a World Cup final? I mean, it wasn't my game, it was the players' game, it was that of the club. I feel disappointed that when I reflect on what should have been the clear highlight of my career, it's tainted. It's tainted because of the type of game it is. And there's a journalist up in South Yorkshire, used to work for the Sheffield Star, a good friend of mine called Les Payne. And I came back and I spoke to Les when I got back. He's a football writer. And he gave this analogy, and I kind of like can relate to it. He said it's a bit like there's a woman who's getting married in a few weeks' time. And, you know, every Saturday in the build-up to the wedding is beautiful, glorious sunshine in this heat wave. Mm. And then her wedding day comes along, her Saturday to get married, and it absolutely pours it down all day.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's still got the photos to say she got married, and she still enjoyed it, and she still went through with it and everything. But just something took the shine off it. Mm. And she'll always remember it absolutely poured it down when she came out of the church, absolutely. And she got wet through. Mm. And it was like with me, you know what I mean? Yeah, I've got the pictures to say that I did it, and I've got the medal, and you know I can think about the great Saturdays in the week in the build up to it, the games that we did. But there is something that takes a shine off that final. And that's why when people say, what is your highlight? I'll say, well, the biggest honour was the World Cup final. But the highlight was 50 days earlier
the
Champions League final, which was exactly this type of game.
But you refereed that game particularly well, though. I mean, everyone said that.
But it wasn't a game which presented the challenges that the World Cup final presented.
Yeah.
I was able to be anonymously competent. There was a part of that game on about 70 minutes after Milito had scored his second goal into Milan where I could there was a small break in play. I was able to look around the stadium and absorb it and think, yes, I've got this game in my pocket.
Thanks, Howard. Thank you so much for seeing that.
Was a Radio Staccato production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.